right, so tonight we are talking as per continuing the series on removing obsessive thoughts. And tonight I'm actually going to be talking about the sutta the Buddha gave, the teaching, in other words, the Buddha gave on that very topic. It's called Removing Obsessive Thoughts Sutta. And I'm not going to be going over all of the tools, I'm just going to be going over the ones that I use in my own practice. Some of the tools are, I find, a little bit outdated, but some of the tools are really, really quite wonderful and quite powerful. So, the Buddha noted that we get hung up in obsessive thoughts, repetitive, intrusive ideas, fears, anxieties, worries, concerns, generally because these thoughts offer us something. As in all things that are born of craving and fear, thoughts that are born of craving offer us the illusion that if we just grab hold or get something, control something, then we will be inoculated from pain. We will never have to suffer. We can somehow be removed from all the inevitable setbacks, disappointments, rejections and abandonments and losses and all the frustrations of daily life. That's the idea. If I only got a hold of this thing, or if only I had done this, or if only I could achieve this, if only I had a better roommate or a better apartment or a better job or a better this or that, I would not have to deal with the inevitable pains of life. And of course, that's illusory, but that's generally what motivates so much of our cravings. And then there's fear. The idea that if we figure out every bad possible thing that could happen to us, every dark turn, every unlikely scenario, that we'll somehow be protected, we'll somehow be prepared. And of course, life shows us that all that worry and fear and anxiety doesn't really stop bad things from happening. It's the nature of life. We're on a roller coaster ride. We get compliments and we get criticism. We get approval and we get disapproval. We get money and we spend it. We become entangled with others and then disentangled. That's the ride we're in for. That's what you signed up, although you don't recall signing those papers. That's what you did when you got your human birth. And there's nothing that we can do about it, but fear and craving offer us the illusion that there's a way out. The third underlying cause for obsession, the Buddha said, is self-fixation that creates delusion. And basically what this idea is, that if only I could figure out who I truly am, my real underlying identity, I could find some purpose amidst that for why I'm here, why I'm alive, what's the whole meaning for this, and then I wouldn't be so confused, I wouldn't be so overwhelmed by life. And that, the Buddha said, is very much an illusion as well, because there is no underlying pre-established or solid identity that we'll ever be able to find. Our experience is a fluid one as human beings. We change, we grow, we develop, we take on new habits, behaviors, thinking processes. We are very much influenced by the world around us, the ideas that people share with us, the things that people say. They all move through the mind and affect us. And so the idea that somehow there's this mystical little core self or soul or identity that if we could just uncover it, we'd understand why we're here, what's our role, and what's our purpose. That's an illusion. It just keeps us caught up in self-fixation. What does this mean? Why did I do this? What's going to happen to me in the future? What do other people think about me? How do I compare to others? Am I doing well? Am I doing poorly? The idea that we'll understand anything about ourselves by speculating, all it gives birth to is more and more obsessive thought. So all these three categories, trying to get or attain or control or maintain or keep or acquire something we don't have, that keeps us in constant thought because we don't have whatever it is. It creates the sense that there's something missing. And so our thoughts flood with, what could it possibly be that will make me feel complete and make me feel worthwhile and make me feel whole? And how can I attain that thing? And where is it? And why don't I have it? And then there's all the thoughts of, how can I prepare myself from all the bad shit that could happen? And then we can sit around thinking about that, the financial struggles, the interpersonal struggles, the struggles we might have at work. And then we sit around on top of all that, caught up in thoughts about, what does this mean about me? And so what this means, the Buddha says, is there's a way these obsessions play out. They don't just play out up here in what's known as papancha, multiplied thought. They also play out in the body. We become tense when we become obsessed, because we're so caught up in the thoughts, we're unaware of physically what's going on with the body. We lose touch with the breath. We become essentially an empty experience. We're no longer at home in the body, taking care of it, relaxing the stresses, breathing in a way that calms us. When we completely flood our awareness up in our thoughts, the body becomes armored and tense and defensive. And that's when it becomes tight and the muscles contract in the stomach and the throat locks and the shoulders become more and more upwards towards the ears and the forehead becomes tight. And then also the mind begins to jump around, trying to figure out what's going on Facebook, and am I posts getting enough likes, what are other people saying, and what's going on in the world, and then back to the fears and the self-obsession or the worries, the concerns, the plans, the fantasies, the dissociative ideations and all that. So that creates a jumpy mind. And the jumpy mind is what undermines our ability to stay focused and attentive. Eventually, awareness becomes like that remote control where people can't settle on a given TV show. We're constantly looking around for, where's the action? So the Buddha proposed in a sutta called the Vitakka Santana, which means getting rid of obsessions. He proposed three ways to release ourselves from this series of, or this parade, this array of repetitive ideation. Noting that all of these thoughts offer us something, the Buddha said the first tool is to replace the obsessive, stressful thoughts with thoughts that literally do offer us something skillful. So what we're not doing is we're not avoiding, pushing away, arguing with the thoughts or acting out of them, which tends to very often be our entire toolbox of working with our thoughts. We either tend to try to push them away or argue with them, or give them a lot of attention, or act out on them. And the answer is in none of the above. The answer is to keep up the level of mental energy, but to entirely replace the thought that is unskillful, that promises us something that it can't deliver, such as fear promises us protection, though it doesn't deliver it, and instead reflect on three things that literally do offer us something very real, very tangible, very empowering. In Buddhist practice, there's a couple of different sets. The most well-known is called the Triple Gem. And this is reflecting on the truths of the Buddha's enlightenment, what he taught, and the community that was created in his wake. Now, what this means is we don't literally think or reflect on the actual Buddha, who may or may not have existed. He may not have been a him, he could have been a her. What we reflect on, though, is that the basic idea that's been practiced for 2,500 years is that the Buddha didn't achieve any sense of lasting peace, awakening, enlightenment, or harmony in his life by acquiring more and more and more stuff. In fact, the story goes, and it's been repeated in the lives of countless nuns and monks, is that he left a life of richness and power and a family and so much abundance and goods and sensual pleasures, and he went off into the jungle, and at Bodh Gaya he sat after 6 years of practice and on his own without any material means, simply by focusing his awareness in with compassion and kindness and appreciation and equanimity, he developed lasting ease within, which is the ultimate goal of life, really, to attain a mind that's truly present, awake, and at peace, and really connected deeply with life. I can tell you from work I've done in hospices, being around people that are dying, not one of them has ever mentioned to me a wish that they had achieved a better title at work or gotten laid more often. Maybe they thought that, but they didn't say that. But I heard many times of gratitude for the moments in life when they were truly awake and connected and deeply touched by life and the people around them. That's what floods the mind when we look back on our lives and try to understand what it was all about. So the Buddha's enlightenment did not come about by getting more and more. It came about by letting go, by renouncing everything he didn't need. He stripped down his life to just the bare essentials. And this doesn't mean we have to do it, but what it means is that when we get caught up in those thoughts of, oh, if only I had this, if only I, you know, wasn't single, or if only I wasn't married, or if only I wasn't living with a roommate, or if only there was somebody nice living here with me, or if only I had a different colleague at work, or if only this or that. And just to realize that none of that holds what it is we're really looking for. It comes about through letting go of trying to establish happiness in that domain, and by simply opening our hearts up to the richness that's present in our lives right now. So in this sense, reflecting on the idea of enlightenment is a great counterbalance to craving and being caught up in desire. On the other hand, reflecting on the teachings of the Buddha, which was basically can be summarized as the following: that in life a lot of good and bad shit happens, but the bulk of our suffering happens because of the way we relate to that good and bad shit. The good and bad shit is a technical term for the first arrow that the world shoots into us. We get insulted, we get rejected, we get compliments, we get promotions and fired, we get downsized, we get marginalized, we get hooked up tuned in, dropped out. I don't know where I'm going with this, but you get the idea. A lot of things happen. But the bulk of the suffering comes in the mental recitation, the mental repetition and replaying, the envisioning of what I should have said to that schmuck when we were talking, all the stories and all the mental commotion or chorea that we make out of it. We, in essence, we replay a single event in our lives many, 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 many times. Why? Because we're looking for some understanding, so that the idea being, if I can just figure out it, I won't ever have to suffer again. If I could just figure out why this breakup happened or why this rejection happened, I won't ever have to feel that pain again. And nothing will ever be able to deliver that. The only thing that reduces our suffering is stopping that whole procedure of trying to figure out and protect ourselves from things we cannot protect ourselves from. And by simply opening into the actual experience, rather than saying, oh, this sucks, this is terrible, I got dumped, I got rejected, they didn't like my painting, they didn't, whatever it is, the people I work with are horrible. Instead, just literally opening into what that feels like and owning that. And bringing a set of compassion for ourselves, rather than going off into the delusion of, if only I'd said this or done that or graduated from another school or whatever it is. Instead, just open to life as it is. We find out when we do that, that everything passes very quickly. That the wounds we thought we couldn't heal actually can be healed very quickly. The thing that keeps the wounds festering is that we don't allow them to breathe and allow them attention. We run away from them into our thoughts of, this is wrong, this is unfair, how dare they? How dare you say that to me? How dare you do what I don't want you to do? And the problem is everybody experiences outrages and slights, and every life has them. There's no way to live without experiencing people acting inappropriately to us. But the repetitive idea that if only I could figure it out or protect myself from this ever happening again, that's where the suffering is. So we really reflect on that. And when we do open to this idea, in my experience, suddenly that thought of why did this happen begins to lose its allure, because we realize it's not offering anything. And that simply the process of moving through life rather than around it is where there is true hope. The third quality of reflecting on the community of people around us is that we generally in life get caught up on one person. There's always one person that we're pissed off with, or infatuated with, or is dominating our attention. That one person that we're monitoring in our minds. And so, very easily, we can become dejected if that one person who we want to return our phone calls doesn't. If that one person we want to return our affections isn't available emotionally. If that one person who rejects us doesn't change their mind. Or whatever it is. When we have a community, we can contact love and support at any time. We just have to let go of the preference of who it is. But it's available. There's that old story about, and it's analogous, you know, the whole person during the flood, praying to God story. You've heard that one, right? No! Oh, no. This is actually one of those stories that is trotted out by virtually every Dharma teacher. Well, I don't know, because it has sort of a Christian theme to it, but it's a nice story, so we'll use it anyway. We don't care. We're desperate for content. So this guy, this very devout theistic guy, and he's in a flood, and it's right now up to his garage, and he's on the roof, and the neighbors row by, and they said, come on, into our rowboat. He's like, no, God will save me. Keep on going. I'll be okay. God will save me. So they go, okay, and they row away. And then, so now it's up to the very beginnings of the gutters. And the police row by with a bullhorn, and they're like, okay, it's time to climb aboard. The waters are not subsiding. And the guy goes, no, no, no. God will save me. God will save me. And he goes back to praying. So now the waters have completely consumed his house, and he's standing on the very tip of it, and a helicopter comes by. And they call down to him with a bullhorn, we're lowering you a rope. We're lowering you a rope. And he's like, no need. No need. God is about to rescue me. So the helicopter shrugs and... Well, the helicopter shrugs, somebody in it shrugs, and the helicopter moves on, and then the waters crest, and he drowns. There's not a happy ending to this story. But anyway, so the guy goes up to heaven, and he meets God, and he says, What was going on there? I prayed, I was devout, I was waiting for you, why didn't you save me? And God said, I know what's going on. I sent you two boats and a helicopter. So, in other words, when we have our preference for the help and the love and the compassion only coming from one place, this is called rescuing the story so that it fits in. Very good. You'll hear every Dharma teacher do this. We tell a story that we like, and then we try to pigeonhole it into the meaning. So the meaning is that if we have preference for one person being the one that gives us the love and support, we'll drown. No, that's not what it means. It means we won't get it. We have to open to wherever the support is. Another wonderful thing the Buddha said, by the way, when it comes to connecting with the community, is that when we find ourselves comparing with others, the real happiness comes from asking what we have in common with others. And that's what we do in a spiritual community. We don't, in essence, bond in the way that people do at high school reunions, where they're trying to show off how much they've accomplished, look good. Yeah, here's the wife and the kids, and this is what I do. We bond on our mutual experiences. We don't compare ourselves by differences. We connect by similarities. And when we think of other people, if we always go to what do I have in common with everybody else in my life, rather than focus on those small differences, immediately the mind stops churning up feelings of low self-esteem that are born of comparing ourselves with others. We have to open again and again to the fact that 99.999% of us are genetically identical. So, a couple of other tools to stop obsessive ideation. The Buddha said, if that doesn't work, reflecting on the Triple Gem, then what we can do is bring the mind's analytical abilities to bear on that visiting ideation. The easiest way to do this is by externalizing the idea and asking ourselves, okay, this thought I have in my mind, how I'm not accomplishing enough, how I should have done so much more, I'm 40-something years old, what the fuck happened? Oh my God, I'm bald, I'm not, I haven't written that book, starred in that movie, written that screenplay, whatever. So we see that thought, and instead of identifying with it because it's going on in our mind, we instead imagine, okay, What would I do if somebody walked down the street that I knew, came up to me and said this thought over and over and over again, like we do to ourselves? Each time you have a thought, ask yourself, okay, somebody I care about walks up to me and says that to me. Would I take them seriously? For example, hello?
Yes?
You will not have enough money in the future. You fucked yourself over. Would you invite somebody into your house with that opening? Would you say, come in? That sounds like a promising conversation. I'm looking forward to hearing more about this. Yeah, hello? Yeah, you blew it. You blew it. Remember when your mom said to study something in money management? Well, those were the words that would have saved you, but instead, you had to study Buddhism and philosophy in college. Look where you are now. So, just externalize the thought. Ask ourselves, would I give this person credence or attention? Or we can imagine somebody that we care about, would we say the same thing that we say to ourselves to somebody else? Could we honestly imagine ourselves repeating the same thoughts that we obsess over to somebody else? If we don't treat ourselves at least as well as we would treat somebody that we care for, that's a big issue worth investigating. If we talk to ourselves in ways we would never talk to another human being, if we treat ourselves with more ongoing repetitive ideations than we would ever do with somebody else, that means we're belittling ourselves in our own mind. One of my teachers, the terrific Tom Jeff, says that a great place to start is to institute Roger's Rules of Order in your mind, which means we don't tolerate ad hominem insults, anything. If somebody starts repeating a point that's already made, we overrule them. I've already heard this. That point's been made. Does anybody have anything new to say? And then we vote. Should we table the issue or do we want to act? The good news is when we do this, when we say, oh, I've already heard this, is there another point of view? That's when we begin to operate on freedom of choice, not on the zombie level of simply acting out on the thought that screams at us the loudest and the most repetitiously. I want food. Another trick he told me, which is pretty unimaginable, but he said, imagine if everybody could hear your thought. Would you feel embarrassed? If there's a thought that you'd feel embarrassed by, don't think it. Now, it sounds kind of obvious, but a lot of us are really secretly glad that nobody can hear our thoughts. And when you investigate that, that means that we lead compartmentalized lives, where a lot of the time we're in there thinking occasionally nasty thoughts that we're glad that are sticking in here. And we feel that's okay, even though, as a result, that creates this sense of tension between what we feel confident and comfortable manifesting in front of others and what we do with ourselves. Another good tool in this domain is practicing as much as possible kind speech in our lives, because when we speak with a sense of kindness and we don't act out in relationships out of frustration and pent-up anger, when we talk skillfully, that habit actually floods into the mind itself. The way we think is very affected by the way we speak to others. In fact, that's all that thinking is. As the great psychologist Lev Vygotsky demonstrated, it's simply internalized speech that happens when we're around 3 or 4 years old. The third tool of relieving ourselves of obsessive ideation is finding where the tension is in the body, always going again and again into the body. And when we're caught up in a repetitive, frightening, obsessive, craving, worrisome, whatever it is that's caught in the mind, just take part of the awareness. Don't fight it. Just take part of the awareness. Allow it to play up there. Don't argue with it. Just say, hi, you're welcome. Stay up there all you want. Chatter away. But find where the tension is in the body and breathe into it and relax it. In my experience, fear is always in a tightness in my belly. Craving is always in my chest, a sense of desire, wanting something, an eye gadget I must have, is this hollowness in my chest. I never got what I wanted as a kid. Why can't I now? There's a sense of anger that's in the shoulders and frustration and in the muscles of the arms, and also a locking of the jaw. In life, we can also abandon the present. When we do so into the computer, we'll notice that the head moves in front of the body and the eyes pin and the forehead tightens. So if we can bring awareness down into the body and relax where all that agitation is being supported beneath it, we do two things. A, we separate awareness from the stickiness up here, and we give it some perspective. As the Buddha said, the more space the mind has, the less loud the thoughts become. And when we relax the body and the breath, the thoughts begin to dissipate. I've worked with many people who have anxiety attacks, and they all don't want to start by relaxing the breath. And that's the way out, always, which is, it sounds like when you're in this thought of, oh my God, I'm trapped, I'm going to die, I'm stuck in the subway, I'm in an elevator, I'm on an escalator, what the fuck am I doing? This is terrible. And you say, okay, how does the breath feel? They're like, what the fuck are you talking about? Didn't you hear me? And you just say, no. Stretch out the out-breath. Keep working on it. When they do this, they begin to pull awareness away from the triggering thoughts. They begin to relax the body. And because of that, they're not fighting the war on two fronts. And it becomes so much more possible to be with a stressful thought when we have some distance from it. So the three tools, again, are replacing the fears and cravings and self-centeredness with thoughts that really deliver something worthwhile and something that really promises us something rewarding, which is reflecting on the possibility that enlightenment doesn't happen because of owning or having money or accumulating friends or popularity, but it comes from compassion and kindness and generosity, none of which requires any consuming. It comes from reflecting on the teachings, which are our suffering comes about by how we use the mind, not by what other people have done to us. When we do that, we have a way out, because we have no control over other people, but we can control what we focus the mind on. It comes from reflecting on our connection with the community. It comes from analyzing the thoughts skillfully, and it comes from releasing and relaxing the body, so that we give the mind a much broader vessel that's much more spacious than just stuck up there with all the repetitive ideas. Whew. So I thank you for listening. I'm going to turn off the tape.